WBEZ's Nonprofit Spotlight is supported by UChicago Medicine, providing expert primary and urgent care with locations throughout Chicagoland. Their walk-in urgent care locations offer a variety of services for adults and kids 7 days a week. No appointment needed. And for the visits that can wait a day or two, flexible hours and online scheduling make it possible to find a primary care provider partner. Learn more at uchicagomedicine.org.
How does AI even work? Where does creativity come from? What's the secret to living longer? TED Radio Hour explores the biggest questions with some of the world's greatest thinkers. They will surprise, challenge, and even change you. Listen to NPR's TED Radio Hour wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey, Chicago, I'm Sasha Ann Simons, and this is In the Loop. On today's show, we talked about quantum computing. A long vacant stretch of Chicago's South Side will soon be home to a massive quantum computing campus. The multi-billion dollar project promises to bring jobs, affordable housing, and new healthcare options to the area. But not everyone is on board. Local residents say they were blindsided by the very idea of this quantum campus. They're concerned that Chicago will go the way of San Francisco, where the influx of tech industry saw residents facing rising rents, gentrification, and displacement. So joining me with more on this is In the Loop senior producer Sienna Greaves. She produced this segment. Hey, Sienna.
Hey, Sasha. How you doing?
Doing well, and looking at you a little bit sideways because you gave me a lot of prep for this conversation.
Just a little short conversation on quantum computing.
Just a little crash course.
Tiny bit of prep there. Easy.
So, I mean, you had to do some of the digging as well and the research. I mean, what surprised you?
Well, I knew quantum computing was like a big deal, but I didn't realize just how big, you know. In the past 5 years, it's morphed into, the best way to describe it is sort of the new moonshot or new moon race. Governments across the globe are pouring billions of dollars to be the first, the best, and fastest in quantum technology. It's pretty fascinating.
Yeah, it definitely sounds fascinating. But, you know, while there's all this excitement around the arrival of this campus on the South Side, there are legitimate concerns from some of the residents who live nearby.
Yeah, as you mentioned, there is a fear of rising rents, gentrification, displacement. Residents on the South Side don't really feel like they have a stake in this new development. Mm-hmm. During my pre-interview with one of our guests, Clifton Muhammad from the Southeast Environmental Task Force, he pointed to several development projects on the South Side that were supposed to be an economic boon for the area and just didn't live up to the hype. So I guess there is a fear that they'll be in that same place again.
And I love the fact that we've put Clifton, who you mentioned, and folks who can sort of describe what's going on the other side at the same table.
At the same table. And when we have these conversations, it's really interesting. I think people come with opposing views, but you realize there are so many more similarities there. So
yeah.
It was a very interesting conversation.
Well, lots to get into. Thank you for stopping by, Sienna.
No problem. Thank you for having me, Sasha.
At the table was Samir Mayakar, former Chicago deputy mayor. He's also associate vice president and managing director of the Polsky Center for Entrepreneurship and Innovation. John Zasajinski, professor of physics with the Illinois Institute of Technology. And Clifton Muhammad, who's a small business owner and member of the Southeast Environmental Task Force. I'm going to start with you, professor. I'm going to give you probably the toughest question this hour. What is quantum computing? And so, explain it in a way that my 72-year-old mom who's listening will understand. Go.
Okay. Quantum computing is a new kind of computing instrument that uses quantum bits, which are the prototype would be an atom would be a quantum bit. I work on a materials that are superconducting qubits. They're larger than atoms, but they behave in the same way. And this type of instrument allows you to do calculations that you cannot do on a conventional processor. By conventional, I mean silicon-based like your laptop.
Like the regular computer that
exactly.
we have in our home.
Those are based on silicon transistors, which are in an off state or an on. If it's off, I can call that the zero state. If it's on, I'll call that the one state. If it's in a zero, I can send a pulse, turn it into a one. If it's in a one, I can turn it back into a zero. So I can manipulate these bits, but there's only two states. With a quantum element, it could be in the two states, but also in what we call the superposition of the two states simultaneously.
So help me understand that in real world terms, because when all the research I've done just shows that quantum computing will solve these real world problems. Like what?
Well, so these quantum bits can be coupled to each other, just like atoms can form molecules. You can make 100 of these quantum bits work cooperatively as one giant type of computing element. And that gives you an access to solving problems that you cannot do with conventional processors. Mm-hmm. So Google works on the type of platform that I work on, which is superconducting qubits. They demonstrated something called quantum supremacy a few years ago. They did a type of calculation in 3 minutes that would take a conventional computer anywhere from 3 months to 10,000 years to do. So this is, it can't solve every problem, but there are certain types of problems that it is really good at solving amount of time that's reasonable.
And before I turn to our other guests here, I want to be clear then, what is quantum computing not? Professor, like, are there general misconceptions about the technology that you want to clear up?
It's not going to replace conventional processors. It will work with them. You will have complicated calculations that conventional computers will do, but then they'll say, oh, well, we need a quantum computer to do this part of the calculation, and then come back. So they will work cooperatively, and that's how it's going to happen.
So talk more, Samir, then, about just some of the differences, because, again, a lot of folks hear this big name, right, about the microelectronics park that's coming to the South Side, but they don't actually understand what it means for their day-to-day and how it's just different from, you know, some of the PCs that we use and laptops that we use every day. What else can you offer?
Well, I think building on what the professor mentioned, so the way I like to think about quantum computing, a computer is there to solve a problem. And if you think about that problem almost like unlocking a door, a traditional computer would use like a set of big keys, and it would use each key in sequence to try and unlock that door. And in the case of a quantum computer, you could use all those keys simultaneously to unlock that door. That's where you get this sort of power where you can kind of tackle problems that traditional computing can't solve. So what could that mean? Imagine like a new form of cryptography where all of a sudden, the entire backbone of our financial system now could get hacked by a quantum computer. So it's going to change that sector. Imagine inventing new types of materials for pharmaceutical applications or energy applications. That's what quantum computers can enable. So, you know.
And that's why it's so much more important.
It's why it's important.
And valuable.
The same way that artificial intelligence today is, you know, unlocking potentially trillions of dollars of value. That's the kind of power that quantum computing can have as well once it starts reaching the market.
What else do we know about the research that's going to be conducted at this facility?
Well, the Illinois Quantum and Microelectronics Park is really kind of a scale-up facility. So quantum research has been happening for many decades. And certainly, you know, my center is based at the University of Chicago. We have basically the top scoring publications almost in the world in the quantum space, and other great schools in Illinois, like the University of Illinois, Illinois Institute of Technology, Northwestern. We have a huge history of doing quantum research. In fact, almost 40% of federal money in quantum research has been going on here in the greater Chicago area. So the quantum park is building on those basic fundamentals to try and then commercialize them, scale them, so that they can have actual impact, you know, in markets.
Yeah. And Clifton, I'll turn to you now. I want you to orient us just a little bit. Paint a picture of exactly where this new campus is going to be located on the South Side. Is it in South Shore?
So this new campus will be in South Chicago, a few blocks down from me, on the old U.S. Steel Steelworks Southworks site, right on the lake between 79th and 95th Street.
Right. And so when you first heard that this massive quantum campus was coming to the neighborhood, what was your initial reaction?
Oh, a mix of excitement and concern. You know, some of the things that Samir talked about and John, I think are exciting, you know, in terms of, you know, what they can bring to humanity. And the concern was around how will, my customers, my residents be able to participate in this? Mm. You know, unexpectedly, I inherited a record shop from my uncle. And, first thing I did was I put up a big liquidation sign because I was going to sell it.
Mm.
And
where's your record shop?
It is on 87th Street right off Commercial. So it's literally walking distance from where the new Quantum site would be. And while I was trying to slick thing, the way I put it is the shop actually refused to cooperate with my liquidation plan. My uncle's customers would walk through the front door, tell me about his 30 years in the community. Neighboring business owners would come through and they'd say, you know what, Cliff, whatever you need to do, we'll help you. Even if you want to put up a taco stand, we'll help you. And they did that.
Yeah.
And essentially what I think they were saying is, we're glad you're still here. What I learned, I didn't realize it at first, is that my uncle really didn't create value simply by selling a commodity and taking a profit off of that. He created value through creating a community space. And that's what we're trying to do with what we're doing now with the shop. So my concern was with this big new neighbor coming is, you know, would they be a good neighbor? Would they connect to the existing community?
Hmm.
Would our residents, my customers, have access to these opportunities? Would we be able to share in that prosperity? Or, and correct me if I'm wrong, John, could some of these thousands of jobs ship away through the internet to other parts of the world?
Mm. Professor, your response to that?
I think having a company in your neighborhood is a huge asset. This is going to be a big deal. A lot of the investment that has been going on in this quantum space has been in research, and Illinois has benefited from the research dollars that have come in. The Department of Energy funded 5 quantum institutes 5 years ago. Mm-hmm. They've been renewed. Out of those 5 institutes, 2 of them are in the Chicago area. That's a tremendous asset. And like Samir said, there is now the intellectual base here to start, let's start making products, mm-hmm. let's start building instruments, and there will be jobs, and people can get trained. And so we are a university, and we are looking how do we change our curriculum? How do we bring some of these topics that are really hard to understand at some level, but actually are simple at other levels. There's wave properties that you could actually teach some of these topics to grade schoolers. And so that you could start to develop this pipeline, this quantum workforce, via education.
Yeah. And I want to note, as you thank you for responding to that question, Professor, but I do want to note we did invite representatives from the Illinois Quantum Microelectronics Park to join us in today's conversation, but they were unavailable to take part. So I want to be clear that you are not representing, of course, that camp. But Samir, you know, along with the environmental and the economic concerns and some of the things you just heard Clifton bring up, some residents also say we want a say. We were blindsided by this. We want some input. In your view, what's in it for them?
Well, this is the right question. And, you know, I'm someone who, you know, worked on the Invest Southwest project, that brought billions of dollars to the South and the West Side.
Yes, under former Mayor Lightfoot.
That's right. And so I spent a lot of time thinking about this site in particular. You know, the U.S. Steel site, we're talking over 400 acres of land. It's bigger than the Loop. And, you know, the site had been, what I had heard from some community members, and Cliff, you might have heard this analogy, it was almost like Charlie Brown on the football, where there were multiple developments over the years that had been proposed. And this site's been vacant since, I think, 92. And none of them came to fruition. But this site finally has gotten financed and has broken ground. And it's really thanks to, you know, community leaders, business leaders, the state, the city, and so many others. So from my perspective, you know, you're taking a generational setback in the kind of abandonment of the site by the steel industry. And now you have a generational opportunity for an entire new industry and an economic development project that could transform kind of the neighborhood, the city, and the region. Mm. At its base, you know, this is a neighborhood that has an unemployment rate that is five times that of where we're sitting in downtown right now. And so what I've heard from community members is we need to make sure that we can have development without displacement, that we have jobs here for people in the neighborhood that we can all benefit. And then ideally, if this Quantum Park is successful, you'll have people who want to live near it and you can capitalize on Cliff. We talked about this earlier. You know, you have thousands of vacant lots there surrounding the site. So the hope is that you can take a depopulated area, build up jobs, build up residents, and have a base of economic opportunity. So ultimately, maybe you have even more customers for that record shop.
I mean, Cliff was concerned about whether ultimately the quantum computing campus would be a good neighbor.
You know, everything I've seen, at least from the signaling of the people involved with this project, is that they very much desire to be a good neighbor. You think about the number of engagement sessions they have. They've been doing something called Saturday Morning Quantum for young people and students to get them engaged from local schools. They've been supporting a quality of life plan that I think is going to get released sometime this year to help really get a sense of the priorities of what's important to folks in the community. You know, this is a project that has a mix of public and private funding. Mm-hmm. And anytime you have that kind of a mix, the stakeholders there have to be good neighbors because they are accountable to so many different stakeholders.
Yeah, well, I'm involved with the Quality of Life Plan, which is really a wish list for the kinds of things that we'd like to see in the community. I would love for someone to put this confidence for how great this thing is going to be in writing, because we haven't seen that yet.
You know, all the promises for jobs?
Yeah, I mean,
et cetera.
If they're going to happen, you know, why not just write it down? You know, so do we know.
So, yeah, some activists have called for a community benefits agreement. Is that what you're alluding to there, Cliff?
Exactly.
Just a way to, of course, offer more input, but also to get some more certainty that
certainty,
we are being factored into this decision.
Accountability. I mean, we've heard about some of the programs that are going on. I mean, the reality is, you know, my wife and I are sitting out in front of our shop, a few months back, and one of my uncle's, you know, customers come by. We've been talking to her over the years. We're like, hey, how's it going? She goes, you know, my son can't find a job. Your son can't find a job. Well, what's he doing? He's in school. Yeah, what school's he at? He's at Illinois Tech, IIT. Well, that's a good school. What's he majoring in? He's majoring in mechanical engineering. Whoa. Well, these are exactly the kinds of skills that we hear are needed for the $9 billion data center that's walking distance from where we talk right now. And he's completely unaware of this opportunity. So my wife and I, you know, we did what we could. We actually found the kid a job, checked on him. He's doing great. But selfishly, the next time that kid walks by my storefront window, I want him to have more dollars in his pocket. And that's the same that I want for all of the residents, because that helps me as a business owner.
Interesting points here brought up by Cliff a moment ago about just the impact on the local job market once this thing comes to town. Your response, Samir?
My response is I agree with Cliff that we need jobs and we need to make sure that young people, especially young people across the South Side where I also live, they need jobs. You know, my sense is that through programs like Saturday Morning Quantum and, you know, this notion that seeing is believing, and that by having this amazing technology park that will host field trips and, you know, internships and all sorts of opportunities once it's up and running, that a new future can be possible for young people because they can actually see those jobs in their community. And, you know, there's so much research that shows that having these major employers in your neighborhood actually helps make that neighborhood a thrive. And certainly that was a goal when I was working with Mayor Lightfoot on Invest Southwest. I think that's the hope here. And, you know, one example of this bearing out is you're seeing spillover economic development now just from the announcements that have already been made. So by having the Illinois Quantum and Microelectronics Park break ground. Now, as Sasha alluded to, there's a new $300 million hospital coming from Advocate. And I really expect more follow-on investment to come. And the net result of all of that, you know, I share that hope that it will help create more jobs for people, especially who live locally. The other case study I'd give is the Discover Call Center. You know, this is near you over at 87th and Cottage Grove. They now employ almost 1,500 people, and this is a major Fortune 500 company, and almost 90% of the employees of that Discover Call Center live within a five-mile radius. So we know this is possible. We know that this can happen on the South Side, and now it's really up to executing it well.
Yeah. Professor, I'm looking to you now because I want to stick with this conversation about young people, right, and students. Are your students excited about this campus?
Oh, absolutely excited. They're aware that quantum computing, quantum information science is a more general term that includes quantum sensing, that these are going to be tremendous opportunities for the future. And I would like to comment that the anchor institution at the IQMP is this company called PsiQuantum, and they will representative will be coming to our campus in a couple of weeks, and we're going to start to discuss the very issues we're discussing here. Mm-hmm. What are the skills that they're going to be looking for in an employee? What can we do? You know, we'll talk. How will we adjust our own curriculum to, point in the directions that will benefit physicists, engineers, mathematicians, things like that?
Yeah. Yeah, this campus is massive. I've said it's 128 acres. It's got a 300,000 square foot, footprint, basically. How much energy is needed to run a high-tech operation of that size?
So I think one of the pieces of misinformation is that this is going to be similar to one of these AI data centers, which use tremendous amounts of energy.
Is that the case here?
No. These quantum computers are much more efficient than conventional, an AI data center is using conventional processors, just lots of them, quadrillion transistors. And those are using a lot of power. The quantum computers are much more efficient. They will not be using quadrillions of processors. They will be able to get away with a million, much smaller amounts. So the amount of energy that will be required is probably 1% of what.
Cliff, was that one of your concerns as well, the energy or, potential increase on electricity bills? Have you heard folks talk about that the South Side?
Here's what I've heard. I think I heard one of the founders talk about co-locating, quantum computers with data centers because, as you explained, Professor, conventional computers are good at some processes, quantum computers are good at others. We don't have anything in writing. We don't know that a data center won't be co-located there. So I'm concerned that I'm a stakeholder. I've invested in this. My electric rates, I would expect, would increase to accommodate for the additional demand that whatever is located there, we don't know what it is going to require. I expect that my property taxes will increase to compensate for the additional demands and incentives. I think there's something like $1.9 billion in federal, state, local tax incentives that have been contributed to this project. But they're still going to use public resources. Somebody's got to pay for that. And as a Chicago taxpayer, I think I'm paying for some of that. What I think would be reasonable is that I get the same respect as the other investors in this investment, and that all of the things that we hear in terms of the great, return on investment be addressed to Chicago taxpayers like myself.
Samir, I'll have you respond to that because, I think he brings up an interesting point about just not, with the lack of information in writing, how can residents know exactly what is to come? How can we say with certainty that this won't impact energy?
Well, Cliff, I mean, these are very fair questions. And, the reality right now in the quantum sector in particular, this is a global race. You know, you have the United States looking to be competitive in this sector that could have massive implications for defense, security, communication, industries of the future. You have Europe investing heavily, and you especially have China investing heavily. So, you know, almost regardless of what we do here in Chicago, a park like this is going to exist in the country. And I think it's fantastic that it's happening here. I think it's fantastic it's going to create jobs. But to your point, there is a significant amount of public investment happening. And what I've heard is, you know, without that investment, we wouldn't have this opportunity to, you know, essentially have this site that could be transformative to our economy. So the way I think about it, and this is certainly something I focused on when I was in City Hall, you know, we've been somewhat stagnant in growth. Our population is somewhat flat. You know, we need to increase the tax base, to your point, so that the burden on all of us as homeowners doesn't continue increasing. Mm-hmm. And I do think it's projects like this that bring that kind of opportunity of jobs, population, economic growth. If you manage that well, ideally it will help keep our taxes from going up more while also, you know, creating opportunities for that next generation. So I'm optimistic, but I do think, you know, for communities on the South Side who've heard many generations of promises, it's good to be skeptical. And I'm hopeful that we can all enable the project's success and having community members like you at the table. I'm just happy that, you know, you're at the table at the quality of life planning sessions. And I would imagine that these stakeholders are going to have to listen to the community members in terms of the, you know, the shape of the development moving forward.
It's good to have all of these perspectives here at the table. And then I go back to something you brought up in the beginning, Cliff. You said, you know, I was happy about this. I was also concerned, right? And so just thinking of that, thinking in that optimistic space, talk to me about the kind of investment that you do want to see made on the South Side, right? What is the vision?
Oh, yeah. There are three things that I'm looking for in terms of investment on the South Side. One is access. The second is connection to our unique culture. And the third is shared prosperity, mm-hmm. right? So in terms of access, whatever comes to the South Side, I'd love for that kid who was, you know, walking by my storefront to be able to walk up and knock on the door and say, hey, what do you guys have for me, right? Not just a presentation, but can I come in and work with you? Can I be an intern? You know, quite honestly, my first job at an engineering firm was sweeping the floors in the shop room. And there's value in that, right? Connection to the community. When I visit a community, I go for what's unique about the character of that community. I hope that whatever investment comes respects the donut shop owner that's near me and doesn't cannibalize future opportunities for the donut shop owner that exists on Commercial Avenue with a donut chain, say, within a campus that grabs those customers before we even get to see them. And then the last thing I'd like to see is some shared prosperity. You talked about PsiQuantum. PsiQuantum has a deal with Queensland, Australia, where they're actually building the first one of these sites, where the government of Queensland, Australia, according to their website, has an equity stake in PsiQuantum, which means that when things blow up and become successful for their project, for their business, the residents of Queensland, Australia actually share in that success. So those are the three things I'm looking for.
I'd like to see something like that here. We'll leave it there for now. There's so much more that we could dive into on this topic. But again, really glad to have all three of you here in studio with us. Cliff Muhammad is member of the Southeast Environmental Task Force. John Zasadzinski is professor of physics at the Illinois Institute of Technology, and Samir Mayakar is associate vice president and managing director of the Polsky Center for Entrepreneurship and Innovation. Thank you all so much.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.
WBEZ's nonprofit spotlight is supported by UChicago Medicine, providing expert primary and urgent care with locations throughout Chicagoland. Their walk-in urgent care locations offer a variety of services for adults and kids 7 days a week. No appointment needed. And for the visits that can wait a day or two, flexible hours and online scheduling make it possible to find a primary care provider partner. Learn more at uchicagomedicine.org.
How does AI even work? Where does creativity come from? What's the secret to living longer? TED Radio Hour explores the biggest questions with some of the world's greatest thinkers. They will surprise, challenge, and even change you. Listen to NPR's TED Radio Hour wherever you get your podcasts.
Okay, now it's time to get into the top local stories of the day. At the table to help me break them down was Claire Lane, WBEZ Morning Edition anchor, and Sarah Karp, WBEZ Education reporter. Violet Miller, who's a reporter for the Chicago Sun-Times, joined us remotely. Now, Chicago is under a winter weather advisory today, and the commute into the WBEZ studios wasn't pretty. Here's Violet.
Yeah, it's pretty rough. I figured, you know, I would give myself an hour and 15 minutes to get in this morning, and that still wasn't enough. So I would like to thank, you know, Windy City Euros for letting me use their parking lot to do this this show this morning. But yeah, it's pretty rough. The roads are still pretty slippery. People are moving very slow, and rightfully so. So yeah, definitely add more time to your commute.
It definitely started coming down in the middle of my drive, which was, you know, right around 7 a.m. And I was caught off guard. I wasn't expecting this today. Was it just me? Was I just not paying attention, Claire? Or
well,
had you been reporting this?
Yes. Yeah. Radio's on, folks. Antenna's up. But with lake effect snow, which is what this is, it is kind of hard to predict.
Right.
National Weather Service was anticipating this to impact most of Northwest Indiana, which is where it's heading. But first, it sort of clipped Chicago on its way to Indy, and we ended up, are still in it at the moment, with a very heavy band of lake effect snow. Mm-hmm. This is supposed to let up within the hour. National Weather Service is saying by 11 o'clock, this heavy band that we're enduring should pretty much be out of the way in terms of the Chicago metro area. Northwest Indiana, though, it's going to get it. They have a winter storm warning in effect actually through Thursday, and that takes effect tomorrow morning. So it's going to continue off and on. So it goes.
How was your drive, Sarah?
Very, very slow. That's really how it was. Yeah, I just, you know, I think Chicagoans know you just got to take it easy and, you know, just go leave enough space in front of you, try to get enough space behind you and take it easy. So there are always some nuts that are driving, you know, like there's no snow and you're just like, okay, let's just hope they don't come too close to me.
But absolutely.
Yeah, to give you an idea, the typical posted speed, like if you're moving at the speed limit on the Eisenhower coming all the way in from I-90, is like 29 minutes. Right now, it's an hour and 45 minutes.
Yeah. Oh, wow. So it definitely got worse after I got into the building safely.
Maybe you made that happen.
Yes.
Oh, I did not. All right, let's move on here, Claire, because Mayor Johnson, who was here on In the Loop yesterday for our monthly Ask the Mayor series, he had strong words for President Trump, and he says he'll see his administration in court. What's going on?
Yeah, so this is, again, an ongoing threat from President Trump to withhold funding to so-called sanctuary estates and sanctuary cities. And he made this speech yesterday, President Trump did. So Johnson is essentially just calling that threat blatantly unconstitutional and immoral. And Governor J.B. Pritzker is also echoing those sentiments, saying American taxpayers should not be treated as pawns. Trump saying again yesterday that all federal payments would end by the end of the month to cities or states that don't assist in his federal immigration enforcement without what he is saying he needs now a judicial warrant. So more of this and more local officials sort of clapping back.
Yeah. And I asked him about Chicago joining the Illinois Attorney General in the lawsuit against the Trump administration immigration crackdown. And here's what he had to say about that action.
As I've said repeatedly, this is about terrorizing and dividing communities. This lawsuit is another effort to provide some real check and balance to this administration. We've used many different tools, as you know, executive orders, legislation, and of course, litigation.
You can listen to that full interview on the In the Loop podcast. Sarah, now to a new study that you reported on. It looks at student attendance in Chicago public schools. What did they find?
So some really interesting things. one thing that they sought to look at is that there's just sort of been this idea post the pandemic that maybe going to school, like attendance, doesn't matter as much because now you have online learning, you have ways to access your assignments online. But what they found was that actually being in school matters more now than before the pandemic. In other words, if you look at the number of days of attendance versus grades and test scores, there's more of a correlation and they go down if you're not in school as much. The second thing that they found is that you, the relationship between a student and the school matters even more post the pandemic. So where kids feel connected, where they feel welcome, where parents feel engaged with the school, those are the schools that are having better attendance rates.
Yeah. No, and it makes perfect sense, right?
It does. It does. I mean, you know, if you can't go to school, if you don't go to school, you're not going to learn.
Right.
I mean, at least you hope that that's the case, that there's some point to going to school, right?
Mm-hmm. And this is consistent across all CPS schools?
Well, it is, but this is one of the sort of findings that's really interesting, and this is there's so much variety among schools. So that there's some schools, they're doing well, and they have, you know, kids that say that they feel welcome and engaged, and they're coming. And then there are other schools where they aren't seeing those type of things, and you can sort of see how kids answer. There's a survey that the kids are given every year called the Five Essentials, where they are asked, you know, how do you feel about your school?
Mm-hmm.
And you can see the correlation between kids that aren't going to school and how they rate their school not being as welcoming. So I think that's something that is worth paying attention to, because a lot of times when you talk to schools that have low attendance, they sort of blame outside things.
Yes.
Like transportation and poverty and homelessness and all these other things. And those things, you know, do matter. You know, it's not like to say that attendance is a complicated thing.
Yeah.
But on the other hand, there are things that you can do that will make kids more willing and open to getting up and going to school. And I should mention that this study looked specifically at middle school and high school students,
yes,
not at younger kids.
Yeah, and to your point that you were making there, I mean, the school climate is strongly associated here as well.
With
right?
attendance. So that's very interesting.
Interesting. What's CPS saying in response?
Well, you know, they basically said we want kids to be in school, and we're reflecting on this study. But one thing is that last month at the Board of Ed meeting, they talked about current attendance trends. And CPS's chronic absenteeism, which is kids that miss more than 18 days, which is a lot in a school year, that's actually a little worse this year so far than last year. And so there's some question as to how immigration enforcement is affecting attendance. And, you know, CPS is basically saying that they need to create a district-wide plan to see if they can implement some of the things that are working at some schools so that they're working at all schools.
Now, Violet, a group of Democratic attorneys general, including Illinois Attorney General Kwame Raoul, they have filed yet another lawsuit, this one challenging the Trump administration as well. Give us details.
Yeah, so this one comes just weeks after another suit over, very similar matters. Midway through December, the Department of Health and Human Services announced proposals for new policies that would restrict Medicare and Medicaid funding from institutions that provided gender-affirming care for youth, and that's 19 and below. So that suit was filed just before Christmas Eve, and the attorneys general seemingly could be getting an early win, and that the government has already agreed to delay those proposals until possibly at least mid-April, awaiting a ruling from a judge. But this new lawsuit is about Title IX funding, the Trump administration also threatening Title IX funding, which goes to schools, other education institutions, sports programs, all these sorts of things. So it's the tune of billions of dollars being threatened for states that don't fall in line with Trump's executive orders, and specifically just his beliefs on transgender people. The administration, put out different executive orders at the start of his term, defining sex as immutable and defined at conception, which is actually at odds with, common science. But the administration is trying to force states into this.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so the attorney general here in Illinois is saying the executive order doesn't just overreach, but it goes against our state law as well. Right.
Yeah. So it would, what they're trying to do is force states to, you know, fall in line with this, but that would actually go against things like the Illinois Human Rights Act and other legislation that's been passed over, you know, the last several decades that provide transgender people protections, discrimination protections specifically in the workplace, at schools, and in other places. And so what the attorney generals are saying is that, you know, to fall in line with this federal order that gives guidance for federal agencies, it's still vague on the states, which is another thing they point to, but that it would be in conflict with state law that already existed.
All right. Well, in other news, concert goers are going to have to pay close attention to the final ticket price going forward. Claire, what's happening at Rosemont and Allstate Arenas?
Yeah, so this is in the Village of Rosemont. The cost of events at the Rosemont Theater and at Allstate is going up. So the board of the Village of Rosemont agreed on Monday to hike what it's called the calling the facility services fee. It's just that fee you see tacked on every ticket you purchase for an event. But at both venues, it's going to go up from $2 to $3. But what's more is that the director of the venues eventually could also then raise that price by an additional dollar.
Oh.
So it could become $4.
There could be more.
There could be more. Daily Herald is reporting that this could happen as early as February 1st. Both online and at the box office. So there's no way to skirt this fee.
Yeah, it's a trend. You know, prices are just going up all around.
Check the fine print.
All around. Let's speak of prices going up and think of grocery stores, because that's another place where we've seen prices just skyrocket lately, but perhaps not so much at Aldi. Are you a shopper at Aldi, Claire?
It depends.
Talking
with Sarah Carper about this, it depends what you can find there or what you need.
Right.
Yeah,
right.
We were just talking about how all Aldis might not be created equal.
They are not.
But business is booming overall for Aldi.
Right. Aldi is expanding rapidly, and that could be because it is more seen as a discount grocer during peak inflation, and it's planning to open more than 180 stores across the country over the next year. The chain, which is based just outside of Chicago, went on an expansion tear. This was after inflation really started to tick up back in 2021. But in food inflation slowed a bit. It's still at 2.4% as of last year. That's the latest data from the U.S. Aldi has sought to snap up that market share as more families, mm-hmm. you know, continue to rely on places like Aldi to get their groceries.
What else are you watching for right now in the news?
Well, talking about absenteeism in schools, there's still a lot of absenteeism downtown. Vacant office space is at an all-time high in Chicago, downtown Chicago, at the end of 2025. Cranes is reporting that the vacancy rate at the end of the year was just over 28%. So that's the highest in its history. And again, this is more than double what it was when the pandemic began. So we haven't really seen a big return. Foot traffic might be returning, but office space, certainly nobody is snapping up those vacated buildings and office corridors downtown.
All right. Well, Violet, let's turn to another story that you reported on. This is about a former employee suing the Chicago Cubs. What happened there?
Yeah. So a former employee filed a lawsuit last week against the Chicago Cubs, alleging that they ignored her complaints of harassment from fellow coworkers there, and then moved to retaliate in letting her go at the end of the season. And so she's a trans woman who worked there from February to October. And during that time, not only did coworkers, but even supervisors encourage others to harass her, according to this lawsuit. She also said that after she made complaints to HR, these complaints leaked out, and then she faced threats of violence from other coworkers, which again saw inaction. But at the end of the season, she was let go while these other coworkers remained in their position. So, you know, she's seeking damages and penalties, as these lawsuits tend to. But when I spoke to her earlier this week, she told me that more than anything, she's hopeful that the lawsuit will hopefully make Wrigley Field a more comfortable place for trans people to work in the future.
And so we're clear. Have we heard anything, any kind of response from the organization?
No, the Cubs organization said they don't comment on pending litigation. So nothing there yet.
Nothing yet. Well, Sarah, folks who still have not been able to get their real ID. Remember that? If they haven't been able to do so at the DMV, it looks like they might be able to have some more opportunity to get that in check.
Right. So I guess you can go now on Saturdays. There's some Saturday hours. February 1st is a deadline after which if you show up at the airport without your real ID, you're going to be charged an extra $45. So it makes sense. Go get them. It's not that bad. You know, you just stand in line a little bit at the office on Clark. And yeah, get it.
Get your real ID.
What can I say?
There's no other way to say it, folks.
That's right.
Just get it.
Just get it.
It's going to make your life a lot easier.
Yeah.
We'll leave it there. WBEZ's Claire Lane and Sarah Karp and Violet Miller with the Sun-Times.
This episode of In the Loop was produced by me, Sienna Greaves, and edited by Ethan Schwab. Sasha Ann Simons is our host. For more in-depth coverage of news and culture in Chicago, be sure to subscribe to this podcast. For a full archive of the show, head over to wbez.org/in the loop. Thanks for listening.